that's over on the shuttle now. And I told Wickham and Parker, let me have those two guys and take them with me, and I'll give you two of the best chief engineers that that program will ever have. Well, they both, neither Parker nor Wickham's ever quite got over this, and hey, by God, they were both good, damn good chief engineers. Was something I'm very, very proud of. Dick's quite young, and only fear ever with him was that we'd kill him, because he's a type of guy that has no limits on the amount of hours he'll work. He'll work all night and then work all the next day and all the next night. So I used to worry a lot about Dick, but the two of them I had with me at Santa Susana. We were all three at the battleship. I was in charge of getting the battleship built with Susie. And that's our single engine firing up there, and there was our first multiple engine firing. And I went to Susie, and I came to Saturn in 61, I guess, and worked for Bill Parker, and I was a project manager for building and getting the site activated up at Susie. And Rocketdyne was our, they had what we call an IDLA, I don't know if you know what that means, Interdivision Work Authorization. In other words, they had all the skills and the smarts and facilities, building of facilities, this type of facility, cryogenics storage, cryogenics transfer type facilities that we didn't necessarily have down here. So our sister division then was the people that we gave the money to, who in turn turned around and got all the A&E, that, you know, the architectural engineering type work done to get the facility designed, and in turn built for us. Well, in charge of that was a guy by the name of Doug Crossland. I don't know if you've run across his name yet. Doug Crossland, he's a native Louisiana. I'm a native Texan, so he and I got
along real well. Is it Texan?
Yeah.
You have an air
about it. Oh, I'm a Texan. And I was the overall guy, you know, for North American, for getting the facility built and getting all the ground support equipment up there and getting it all installed, getting it all checked out. Then all the subsystems on the battleship was a stainless steel vehicle that was built to simulate an S-2. In other words, it wasn't a direct replica of the S-2. It was built out of a stainless steel with the idea that for safety, because we weren't real sure, no one had ever fired multiple hydrogen fueled engine before.
This is the first time it's used?
Yeah, and the J2 engine. And so we were all pretty leery on what would happen or what could happen. So from a safety standpoint, it was all stainless steel construction. In other words, that's the name battleship. It's heavy. And it was a 5-engine vehicle. We started off due to schedule pressures. We couldn't make it to begin with a 5-engine configuration. So we fired initially 1 engine. It was really just kind of give us confidence that that we had the skills and the GSE and the facility that could control a 5-engine firing. So we installed 1 engine and fired it up. And then we went through an installation of putting the other 4 inches on the subsystems that went with it. And then we fired all 5 engines then in April, then the following year. We fired initially, fired 9 days late. I fired 8 days late, actually. I fired November the 9th. And I had a contractual date with November the 4th, 1st. I had a 5th of whiskey bet with Dan Driscoll and Carl Heinberg that I would fire before they did on the S-1, and by God, I beat them. Yeah, the bet was they had to deliver it to me. 5th cut, sorry. But, so Dick was my project engineer for that, and Billy Zell was my deputy. Mm-hmm. Two real fine guys, real, real good men. So from there, we went to the 5-engine firing, and then at that time, there's another picture of the test stand that you can't quite, yeah, here, you can see the superstructure back here. The superstructure back here, so this was what we call COCO 1. That's a COCO 1 area in Susie, and this was COCO 4. In other words, the number 4 test stand in the COCO, the C area. And that was built to fire S2T initially, but due to money problems, we decided it'd probably be best, when I say we, it wasn't a unilateral thing, it was us and the customer, Dr. Rudolph, Everhart Reeds, that the concept of firing S2T at the hill, we couldn't fire for 25 seconds also because of safety. In other words, it was a flight type stage. It wasn't built to fly, but it was an aluminum stage.
Where'd you get that safety requirement? Was the Air Force lay that on?
Well, it was Air Force, and also it was a safety requirement that the facility up there was built on based on the adjacent civilian communities. In other words, you go over the hill from there, and there are civilian communities, farms and such, all about 4 miles away. In fact, there was one farmer out there that continually gave us hell due to noise. He had some cows. Even with the battleship, he was just raising hell with us all the time about noise. And that was only about, in air miles, it'd probably be about 2 miles. And Susie sits in a bunch of rills and ridges, and the Coco, those test stands sit kind of on top of the hill, so you do get some hellacious wild noise out of them. In other words, you come down the flame bucket with the noise, and it bounces off of a hill and sails up, and the heads start coming apart. The people that gave us the hardest amount of pressure to keep the noise down were the people on the backside of us, because when we got the right, inversion head, atmospheric inversion heads, the prevailing winds went up the flame bucket and back to the backside, which early in the program gave us trouble, not from noise standpoint, but being able to chill the engines down. That's another story we finally solved later, about a year later, but try to get, inside of a red line on chilling the thrust chambers down. But in any case, though, the S2T then had a limitation on it, that we could only fire 25 seconds. Well, from a 6-minute flight standpoint, that wasn't ever really real satisfactory. It give you, engine start transits, this type of thing, and you get into steady state. But from a, you'd never ever be, get, PU step, propellant utilization step function at all, because that came in around 200 seconds. So that would be well below that. So there's a lot of things that we didn't really like about having to fire up there, other than just safety. There was just a hell of a lot of limitations on us from a facility standpoint. Plus that, we wanted to prove out with the T-Bird, we wanted to prove out the automatic GSE. The battleship was fired with what we call SDD, System Development Devices. In other words, it was a manual type programming system. In other words, hey, throw a switch something other, and throw a switch something other, and so it was. And it was set to be real simple because it's a development device, and we wanted to stair step real slowly through how did you control the five high powered engines. For the S2T was a follow-on, and it was to be programmed and then in turn controlled during the firing with automatic ground support equipment. And that turned out to be quite a step too, because here you got a brand new vehicle, you got all this brand new GSE, and you got all these brand new people. And we decided, it would probably be better if we went to Mississippi to do this. If we don't fire T-Bird at the hill, let's go to Mississippi, because there we can fire uninhibited, full length. We can also save a complete set of GSE, and don't ask me to quote the dollars, I don't remember what it's worth. Some financial guy can probably tell you, but it's quite expensive. I guess 50 million or more, probably for a complete, set of GSE. And the idea was that that same set of GSE had to be duplicated again at MTF, and so we could save the price at least on one complete set by going there. In other words, take the Bird there, take the GSE there, because Mississippi is going to be our acceptance firing facility, and it had to have a complete set of GSE also.
Now, both stands are fully equipped down at Mississippi?
Yes,
GSE.
A1 and A2. They got a common control center, but they got separate GSE.
Mm-hmm.
So we said we could save one complete set of GSE down there. In other words, so before we'd had three sets, in other words, one for the hill, two for Mississippi, this would ace out the set for the hill, and we would use a set of MTF. We said that we have to speed up a little bit, something like 6 or 7 months, the delivery of the first set of equipment to support us down there if we did that. But it had a lot of benefits in doing that. So I went down and I was at the Cape on a visit. We were looking at the that and trying to figure out that at that time, North American was still going to finish, furnish, North American S2 was going to furnish a lot of GSE for the LUT. Later that would change, but at that time, and I was down going through all the drawings and the ICDs that we had to support the KSC people with. And I got a phone call that said, come to Huntsville tonight because you have to brief tomorrow. And what on? Well, we had a big meeting back here and you weren't here, unfortunately, but we feel that bringing T-Bird to Mississippi is the best, you know, the best thing to do. Well, I had kind of been pitching this for about 3 months anyhow. And they said, so I want you to brief Von Brown, Reese, Rudolph, Crowd tomorrow. And Jesus Christ, tomorrow? Yeah, tomorrow. I said, okay, I didn't get to barely brief them. So you data faxed to me at the Huntsville office all of the GSE delivery dates and give me all the schedule dates on the facilities construction that the Corps of Engineers do, and I'll put it all together tonight. So I spent up all night and got a briefing together. Briefed them all the next day, and they said, okay, that's a good deal. Only thing is, I made one mistake. I said we'd fire January the 2nd. We didn't fire until April the 23rd because we had hail off hay. Never getting that far. It was a sudden, putting a new facility, new GSE, a new bird, and new people all together and making them all work is a real challenge, believe me. Gray hairs. So that's how we got to Mississippi. With the S2T. I'm just giving you the background of it. Had to do with the ability to fire for a long duration and our ability to save some money in GSE. I hope it's that. So then I came back home and I don't remember. Let's see, that was about 65, early 65, I guess that was, like even that pitch down there that day. I came back home and got the battleship squared away and told my wife the fond news that Ed would now be gone from home again because I'd been living in a motel up at Susie for about 6 months because it got so bad that, working 7 days a week and being there to 1 or 2 o'clock. And I lived in La Habra, that's about 95 road miles. So you drive all the way home, you get home at 2:30 or 3, and then get back up at 5, and drive back up there. So I just started staying in a motel up at Canola Park. In fact, Dick Schwartz stayed there with me, John Nagamatsu, Billy Zell, there's a whole bunch of us just said, hell, that ain't worth it. But we had one guy didn't get killed, but he got hurt real bad on the freeway and went to sleep. Mm-hmm. So I started discouraging the guys from doing that and got the company to pick our tab up there to stay, for not our meals, but our bed tab, so to speak. Another guy was Hank Ethor. So it was about 10 or 15 of us, Don Benz, stayed up there in a motel. So came back home and told my wife, honey, all through at the battleship, I got that thing going, I'm gonna leave Milo Olson, who is one of my guys I have here with me now on the CSM, I'm gonna leave him in charge up there and I'm going to Mississippi. And I'll see you when I get back. And I'll try to get home every 2 or 3 months. And, so, goodbye. And so I went down there and then started the whole thing all over again of trying to get people down there that were responsible. That's my two daughters you're looking at there, and my granddaughter and my grandfather now. But by the way, that same year, my oldest daughter had just enrolled in UCSB. And I didn't get to go up to weather or opening day, and I didn't get to go to the the sorority open house. She was a Pi Phi. I missed that. But anyhow, I went to Mississippi and started trying to get a crew of guys that could go down there that put a site together because I still had the guys I had to leave at Susie because we weren't through with the battleship yet. So that bottom row of guys up there are the people that I eventually ended up. Well, first I pulled Swartz out of Susie and John Nagamatsu and took them down. Then I came back and talked Billy Zell and his wife into going. And I promised Bill that he only had to go 1 year. unfortunately, there's also a hurricane that year, Hurricane Betsy. But anyhow, I got all these guys' wives together and talked the company into sending them their wives down there for a little goodwill trip, and I took them all out and wined and dined them and told them this is the greatest place in the world, because mosquitoes ate them up. But so we got them all. Don Sapp is not on that picture there. Don was one of our real key people. He's our Huntsville rep now in the shuttle. So there's one other, let's say there's one guy, two guys missing up there. Was three. It was Billy Sale, Don Sapp, and John Nakamatsu. Their picture's not up there. But that was the hardcore of the guys that that I conned into, and I said, frankly. And their wives, some of them don't like me very much anymore. And they're going to Mississippi. And then we beat the bushes all over the place trying to get people down there with us. I borrowed people from back here in engineering, and I could maybe sometime we'll get up there for a month or 2 months or whatever. For instance, Bill Bright, who works for me here now, he's in charge of CSM test out here for me. He was at Neosho. I got him and his wife to come down, but his wife, she says, no, but hell no. They were going to close Neosho down within just a few months, and I had heard that Bill was a real good man. I didn't know him. I thought, well, hell, that's worth a gamble, so I got him down. But right in the middle of this, we had Hurricane Betsy, as I said, which was another deterrent then. I had just gotten my hardcore guys there, just gotten them down there. They had just bought homes, a lot of them. And by God, a whole bunch of them lost their homes in that initial Betsy. Or didn't lose me. If they didn't lose it, they lost all the furniture they had and all the rugs and all that. So we finally did get a workforce all that could hang together. And, and eventually went through enough tankings due to Carl Heiberg, bless his heart. He's a believer that you always go through several development steps, and he's turned out he was very, very correct in those steps, I might add. He and Dan Driscoll, Bill Grafton. Do you know Bill?
No, yeah.
Well, we were having so much trouble that I went to Reese and Heiberg and Jack Balsh and requested that they, when I say trouble, the amount of interfaces you have, let me explain the word trouble. When you're at a place like that that you're building brand new, and there's lots and lots of interfaces you have with government agencies, within NASA, within the Corps of Engineers, various, you know, headquarters units, safety people, God knows what else, plus all industry. I went to them and said, hey, I gotta have one guy that I deal with. You asked for one guy to deal with in North America, and I'm it. Now, where's your guy? And they said, all right, we'll get you one. So it was Bill Grafton, and he was one of the finest people I've ever met. I had never known Bill, had never worked with him. I'd known Carl, known Dan Driscoll real well, but I didn't know Bill. Bill worked for Carl. He was head of Capone's lab, test lab over at Huntsville. So they sent Bill down. And without him, I'm tell you, I never ever got through. I think I'd still be there. So Bill came down and represented in NASA. And between the two of us, we've been teased a lot of times by various people that we were the only two that ever knew what was going on, that we were walking encyclopedias of what was happening, but we weren't telling nobody else. We always said, yeah, because we were afraid to. But afraid of intervention, you know, just leave us alone, we'll get this thing done for you. But anyhow, once Bill got there, things did start straightening out, and it really helped just having one guy that I had to interface with. And eventually we did get all our equipment there, and I could sit and talk for hours about the problems we had there again. You got a vehicle that's changing the configuration. You got the ground support equipment that has to change to keep up with it. Then in turn, you got the tail end of the thing, the facility, and all the facility's wiring that has to match up, that interfaces these things together. So I talk a long time about all those troubles, but from a historical standpoint, I guess that means much. But anyhow, we did go through our LN2 tank, and that's LN2 in the hydrogen tank, LN2 in the LOX tank, in order to try to keep things as safe as we could. And then LN2 in the LOX tank, LH2 in the hydrogen, hydrogen tank. And then full up, and then go. And took us, we started a count one afternoon, the first count, you know, for the firing. At about, 1 o'clock, I closed gates, don't close gates. And we finally fired the next morning at 7 o'clock. What an act. And almost backed out at midnight, because we had two false starts. And went out and changed the fire detector probes with the stage loaded. Something I never had guts to do again. But
you did that yourself?
No, I was going to. I went with the guys down to the tunnel. But then Bill Grafton says, "Hey, Ed, you shouldn't do that. If something should happen, there ought to be someone here in the control center that, you know, some charge, and it might be real chaos." That turned out to be not a bad decision, because we caught on fire then about a month later, and I found out really what he really meant. First time someone sees a hydrogen fire is kind of horrifying, especially if you're loaded with oxygen right below it, and it gets pretty hairy, and the people tend to panic.
When was this?
On a Saturday. We blew it up on the 29th. And that was on a, we worked so many days, that was on a, the 25th, I believe, that we got the 100, we caught on fire at 196 seconds. It was about 4 days before we blew it up. In fact, while we blew it up, we were looking for the leak that we caught on fire with. This is the opposite test stand, really.
That's from the observation tower, that picture?
Yeah. This is the E1 stand. That's the gray stand. The blue stand, the A2 stand, is the one we blew the T-bird up in. It's the stand on it. Well, here. Sorry. Yeah, I'm looking right past it. See all the superstructure around here?
Mm-hmm.
That was gold. This was sent down. We had to take this down and put it around the bird in order to try to fix up the insulation. We had so much trouble with the insulation. It was a purged insulation. That's not what they fly with now. They have a foam insulation. But the only way we could patch up this whole sidewall, that's a pretty big stage, was to get a contractor in and build the all the superstructure around here that enabled the technicians to, you know, call right up and work on the insulation. So during the actual firing, this was all taken down after we started tanking and got rid of the fire. But see this outlet right here?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you look at that, that's looking right from the control center.
Mm-hmm.
We sprung a leak right in that area. We didn't know where, and we were saying we were firing. We were at 196 seconds, and hit the stop go, you know, hit the stop button, and the flame, you know, it's coming way up here. LOX tank sits down in the area. That's a hydrogen tank,
right?
This is a hydrogen outlet feed to the number 4 engine. And so we burned for about, it took us about an hour and a half to put this sun gun out.
How'd you put it out?
Well, we finally got the hydrogen all pumped out of the vehicle. It's water don't really put out hydrogen fire. It just controls it. In other words, what we do, we turn the fire exo on the test stand, and it floods the whole area. You know, you just pump it out of the ground. And what you do, you just control it. In other words, you don't let it burn away from you. And then we start pumping it over. When I say pumping, you don't really pump hydrogen, you pressurize the vehicle and push it out.
Uh-huh.
Pushed out to...
when you're dumping cons, one of those big...
Down there, we dump to a burn stack.
That's a big facility's burn stack. There's not a picture here. It's a great...
This is one of these facilities that has a ball in it and it goes into the...
You bring liquid down, or it's critical. It's not really liquid. It's critical mass down to the... sphere, and that allows it to expand and gasify, and then out through the burn stack. It's a 36-inch stack we had down there. Should have heard it the first night we ever fired that sun gun off, but aspirated. I never heard such a goddamn explosion in my life.
Air had gotten back down there.
Yeah. Finally came up for a fix with that too. belts. Also, the first time we ever hit that cell again with a liquid hydrogen, the transfer line's over. The power of cryogenics, I think, finally meant something to me. We had it's a 36-inch line, about so big it runs over land.
From the stand to the, it's too bad I don't have a picture, it runs,
it comes down the back side of the stand around and then over, and the burn stack sits right with the control center in Mississippi. And actually, when we shocked that cell gun, we had enough liquid in it that it actually moved the cement pilings about 4 feet through solid dirt. It moved every one of those pilings right through the dirt. The line was just like this. The vent line, of all things. I couldn't believe it. You could hear it even in the control center screeching. Got to roll like out there and it just...
Oh, this is the pipe moving?
Yeah, the vent pipes. Yeah. Did it rip the burn stack?
Did they blow?
No. Everything
went gone. They just moved the pipes?
Just moved the pipes. It moved the pilings right over, right through the mud. The most amazing thing I've ever seen in my life. I just couldn't believe it. Because believe me, that's a hell of a lot of weight.
This is when you were venting at the time of the fire? Or
yeah, this is the very initial fires. What we did then, we put some more expansion joints in so that would happen again. So, but during the firing, after we caught on fire, we were venting out and pumping back to the barge. We were going out two ways. So, say we got the fire put out, and then decision was made on a Saturday following that we wouldn't fire again. Wait, looking at my pictures?
Mm-hmm.
I'm part Indian. This is my favorite right over here. As I always tease people, I say, the Indian over there is about to get white eyes. See, you can't see it maybe where you're sitting, but he has a spear and he's just a, that's Remington's picture. Probably.
Is this a Remington too?
No, this is a Russell. It was 1909 on this one, I think. This one was in 1890s. But I always wonder what the story really is behind this, because Remington always had a lot of action. But if you look at the distance between the tip of this and the speed he's going, this poor kid with his son back, he's never going to be able to swap that Indian with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I always wonder, what really was the sequel of that picture? Who got who?
Did you get that picture?
So anyhow, we did get the fire out, and 4 days later on a Saturday, which was our first three-day holiday that I was going to give the guys off. It was Memorial Day. Sam Yarkin, who was the S2 program manager then for NASA, and Heinberg called me at about 2:00 and said, "Hey, Ed, congratulations! You've had a wonderful program. We've never seen anything like it, and get the stage ready. We can bring it to Huntsville. We're going to make a dynamics bird out of it. And no more firing, that's the end of the program. And thanks a whole lot for all the hard work and pass a good word on to the guys and all this business. And if there's any way you could find the source of that leak, we'd be awfully interested in knowing." So that was on Saturday, and I got everybody together, the night shift, and the guys that went off from day shift, and told them what a fine job they'd done, and thanked them, and told them they could have off Saturday, Sunday and Monday, and tell all the wives I said hello. And, hey, night shift, here's what I want you to do tonight. Here's the things that are priority and what we've got all disconnected on the vehicle, in the way of the pressurization system, been trying to find all day long. We have no little problem during that firing on the regulator to the hydrogen tank. We've been looking for that. So we got all this disconnected, and when you get that back together, we're real sure we know what the problem area is. Next thing I want you to do is run her up to 8 PSI, the hydrogen tank, and let's run some with helium, and let's run some spot checks to see if we can't find out where that leak was around this cell phone. and it all sounds real straightforward and all that, and then, you know, real easy. And I still have a little picture of the blackboard where I put 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But what I want you to do, and so they said, okay, and again, thanks a whole lot for all the good work. And that was at 4:45.